Welcome to Sacred Realms, a podcast where a rabbi, a pastor, and a Bible scholar discuss the nexus of science fiction, fantasy, religion, and spirituality. We are
Rabbi Andrew Pepperstone,
Matthew Umberger,
Pastor Travis Smith McKee. And this episode is about the sacred, focusing on Superman in particular, but not limited to the recent version directed by James Gunn. So how's everyone doing?
Good. I saw the Fantastic Four again this week, which was very good to see again. Saw F1 as well. Also kind of fantasy, but nice to see it on the big screen. And my dad was here for the week. We had a lovely visit.
Wonderful.
Yeah. How about you guys?
I took my kids to see Fantastic Four and Superman back-to-back at the drive-in this week. And that was a lot of fun. And it was interesting seeing them together, because there's some common themes there as well.
I think the drive-in is a lost art. We need to have more movies that way. Saw one of the first Batmans at the drive-in. I grew up near, if you've ever seen The Outsiders,
yeah,
the drive-in theater there, because it's set in Tulsa, Oklahoma, I grew up living near the Admiral Twin drive-in that's in that movie. So I saw Batman there. I saw Apollo 13, which so cool to see stars in the sky and on the movie screen. And then Cars. I think seeing Cars there was really kind of iconic.
Oh, yeah.
Being off of Route 66, seeing a movie so focused on Route 66 on a drive-in.
That's interesting.
A lot of nostalgia.
That's a very specially placed drive-thru. That's not your typical drive-thru, for sure. Okay. That's really cool.
Yeah. No, I've been good. Been doing a lot of church camp and other things, and so I'm looking forward to a regular week coming up, maybe. Yeah. We'll find out if I've got those.
Get to rest a little bit.
Okay. I have. I took a nap yesterday. That was beautiful.
Congratulations.
Napping is beautiful. Yeah. Summer's over in my household this coming week. Matan's back in school next Thursday. Yep. And my middle daughter's home before her semester abroad. And her oldest coming home for a week before her semester begins. So it's sort of like end of summer. Yep. And then everyone's off and back at school.
We have faculty meetings next week.
I'm so sorry to hear that.
Yeah. So here we go.
I've got fall high holiday sermon thoughts planning. Ooh. So I'm working on sermons and thinking about the fall festivals. For sure. Planning service schedules and security schedules and sermon topics and all that good stuff. So we all saw Superman a couple weeks ago, the new one by James Gunn. And nice we saw it together. That was great.
Yeah, a lot of fun.
Yeah. And I think we each saw it.
I've seen it twice now.
I saw it twice.
I've just seen it once.
Okay. So I guess first, how does this compare to other versions of Superman? I have seen all of the movie versions. I have not seen hardly any of the TV versions.
Yeah.
I didn't watch Smallville, didn't watch Lois and Clark.
I just
know the Donner versions and the Henry Cavill. Oh, I don't know the Was there a movie before Henry Cavill was Superman? Were those all TV?
I think those are all TV. Kane is his last name.
Dean Kane. That was TV.
What was that one? New Adventures of... Was it Lois and Clark or something? I watched those a little bit back when
I was Terry Hatcher as Lois Lane?
Yeah. Those were kind of fun.
Yeah. He joined ICE this week. How special.
Oh,
is that
well,
Dean Kane?
That's kind of ironic.
It really... The irony is not lost on him himself.
Okay.
Super. Well, anyway, so how does this James Gunn version compare for you to any of the earlier versions? For me, it was superlative. Even better than Christopher Reeve, which I hold very dear in my heart as a child of the 70s. Especially Superman's 1 and 2, 3 and 4, we shan't speak of.
I have a soft spot in my heart for Superman 3, but just because reruns when I was a kid, and Richard Pryor, but whatever.
Yeah.
But I hear you. No, I think this is my favorite as well. It's been a joy both times I've seen it. Yeah.
I've being on the slightly younger end of our crew right here, I never had that direct relationship with the Christopher Reeve films. It was always a little bit more reaching back, not necessarily my own nostalgia in that way. So I've seen a lot of hit and misses when it's come to Superman. The biggest movie presentations have been the DC...
The Snyderverse.
The Snyderverse. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the hyper-gritty and everything like that. So this was...
Grimdark, isn't that
what it was? Oh my gosh. Yeah.
That's a very fitting term.
I appreciated the melding of actual up-to-date effects with some actual storytelling that really felt...
Yeah.
That felt nuanced and complicated.
Yeah. Yeah. What would you say are some misses then? With the Snyder films?
From my perspective, they never quite resonated with me in the way that I would hope they would. There's something so hyper serious about Snyder's presentation that I've never really been able to get into it.
Yeah.
Not just for the hyper serious, but something that doesn't show the flaws that this one is showing absolutely from the, literal opening scene.
Yeah.
Is Superman is a flawed character.
Yeah.
Versus the flaw is just we have to accept that he's angry or, various things like that. So anyway, I really appreciated this. And it took something from cartoon Superman. And pushed it forward to make that into a movie, a universe he could really sit in for a while.
Yeah, so the Donner ones had humor. There was a lot of really funny stuff with Lex Luthor and Otis. And
it's almost slapstick, though.
A little bit slapstick.
Yeah.
But even in the first one, there is some nice dry delivery by Gene Hackman as Lex Luthor, which is sort of funny. And Superman, the serious one, he's very serious.
That's true.
Where this Superman, he's a little more comical. Hey, buddy, eyes up here and fool me. So he's a little funnier.
Yeah.
Christopher Reeve's Superman was very earnest, very serious, self-prepossessed. And, the awkwardness of Superman, of Clark Kent, clearly was more of a cover story.
Yeah.
You see in that one scene when he's almost going to tell Lois who he is, he kind of straightens up. It's like, oh my God, half a foot taller.
That's
takes
right.
off the glasses. He's like, he's physically transformed as only an amazing actor can do. But this Clark Kent is, as you were saying, Matt, fish out of water. He's just clumsy. He's not great in crowds.
Yeah.
So I like that it was a little more grounded Clark Kent and a little more funny and didn't take itself as seriously, and that we're in an established world where he is not the first superhero on the block. He's just the most powerful and the most recent, and he's to have walked into this world where it's another one, but a whole new level.
Yeah, people aren't astounded by him like they are in the Donner films.
Yeah,
there's he's the most powerful, I guess.
And I assume because of Green Lantern being there, they know about alien troublemakers.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, why would he be there? So, the background of that interdimensional imp raises no concern in the film.
Another They've interdimensional imp.
Yeah. One thing I was thinking about in terms of religious, is thinking about how within religious traditions, stories about particular figures change over time.
Mm-hmm.
Like the way we tell stories about, certain figures in our respective faith traditions reflect the time period in which they're being told.
Yeah.
So I think about in classic rabbinic midrash in particular, I'll come back to the way that we tell Abraham stories.
Yeah.
Like the rabbis tell Abraham stories where he is this intuitive philosopher who infers monotheism from the shortest of worldly observation and just figures it out and then becomes this iconoclastic figure against the entire world, where he becomes the antithesis of everything and has to fight. and, you know, gather his followers and fight, that the rabbis sort of reframe him that way, which is not at all present in the written Torah at all. But that's like their telling of Abraham as this heroic monotheist. And that's the rabbis living in a largely pagan polytheistic world, where Israel was the only monotheistic people on the planet for a long time, and he was like the beginning of that into monotheism, or just monotheism in general. And sort of they sort of would paint him in that way. Whether he was or wasn't does not matter, but they paint him that way to kind of like retrospectively make him the monotheist, the iconoclast,
trying to make it also philosophically respectable in a in a world where philosophy
in
is
a Greco-Roman
becoming,
world, because the rabbis are Greco-Roman Jews, and they're writing a Greco-Roman Abraham for a Greco-Roman time, for a Greco-Roman Jewish and Gentile audience.
Right,
and they know that people are aware of their storytelling, and there's dialogue between the early church and the rabbis about biblical figures. We know this from a lot of parallels. So, you know, the retelling of Superman just reminds me of how we've always been retelling stories about beloved figures and characters over and over and over again. So the fact that we have, like, you know, the Donner version, the Snyder version, and the Gunn version, that's normal. That's not, maybe not so close together, but that is standard storytelling, where you take these archetypes and you retell them over and over and over again to shed light on whatever's being talked about today, which is clearly about what does it mean to be human, or how do we relate to aliens, foreigners, the outsider. That's just a motif that's what religion does, and pop culture, and there's a blurry line.
I think that's kind of interesting to be able to drop us into the middle of the Superman story. We're not getting the origins, we're not even really getting this moment of just peak Superman or anything like that. We're getting that 3 minutes ago is the first time he's lost a fight. We get this bit of history, but then we jump right into, we know things about Superman, and within the first seconds of the movie we are being confronted with that in a way that challenges us, and it doesn't stop for the entire movie. What does it mean to be human / Kryptonian, I guess, but or Kansan.
Yeah,
in many ways, as we sit here in the heart of Kansas.
Yeah, I think he's the most Kansan Superman yet, which I think I really love about him. It's interesting. You're talking about like how contemporary it is, but for me, it also felt like it is digging deep into Superman's roots. This is the most comic book Superman.
Yeah,
we've gotten. It feels like to me.
Yeah, I know nothing of the comic books.
Okay.
Personally, I did read Birthright, that particular graphic novel, which I adored.
I haven't
and
read
loved.
That.
It's very much one of the inspirations that James Gunn drew upon.
Mm-hmm.
I happen to read it for like whatever reasons. Not that I've always read these comics. I was told, "Oh, read this. It's a whole new take on Superman, where when he shows up." There's all this xenophobia around him as an alien, and Lex Luthor fabricates that he is just the Vanguard scout for an invading force, using Kryptonian records that he manipulates to create fear. In this version, no need to manipulate, there's just a recording that can cause fear, or make people turn on Superman as a one-man invading force. But that's where that comes from.
Okay.
So that was a very great... But I remember as a kid that there was Crypto, the dog.
Oh, yeah.
And did not know that he was omitted from the Donner films because he thought it was kind of silly, because it is.
Yeah.
But let's go back to some of the silly.
Yeah. No, I think that's what I mean. Like, there's a little... I've read a bunch of... I like reading old comics, like, finding them online and stuff. And, yeah, I've read, like, the 1930s Superman, and this feels a little more like that, you know. He's not fighting gangsters. That's the big difference.
Uh-huh.
But it's still like that, you know, the do-gooder kind of thing that I appreciate. I haven't read these comics, but I've seen somewhere references to All-Star Superman by Grant Morrison. I guess that was another big influence.
I've heard reference to it.
And I guess those are fantastic as well. But a lot of people talk about how they kind of also are kind of nostalgic, like trying to... you know, recover the golden age Superman that had been sort of getting rid of some of the edgier stuff that crept up in the 80s and 90s. Uh-huh. You know, like, I don't know.
That the modern aspect of it, I think, gets to how the story is told.
Yeah.
And where the focus becomes as well. So, to your point, talking about fighting gangsters, fighting gangsters is not an international or even universal thing that's right. going on. Gangsters are gangsters where they are.
Yeah.
And you can go from local the realm things. Of one gangster to the realm of another gangster or something to that effect. But Superman is simultaneously here expanding where he is having an impact.
Yeah.
With what's the wormhole, the time hole?
Pocket universe.
The pocket universe, thank you. But also coming back to individuals within this story, individuals within this fight. And I think that's something that it's a reaction against what's gone on right there. We're seeing Superman rescuing people, rescuing squirrels, even.
Yeah, not just people, but like life. Yeah, he's got this deep reverence for all living things.
Which, that's maybe a reaction back as to what's going on. And that, I don't know, that's something that I think is good to have in our modern society. Caring about life.
Although Bravia and Jaranpur are old, like original 1930s Superman fictional countries.
Yeah.
So that's also issue two is Bravia. Yeah, these are like really
old. Oh, really? Okay.
I had no idea. These are really old. So they're drawing back on things that were, he was always global, but then he became very localized.
Yeah. And
then the pendulum swings back.
If I remember right, I've read that issue years ago, but he's like, it's the whole thing of trying to stop a war. They're trying to,
So he originally was very global,
and then
he's also very local and gangster focused. You know, it's very interesting, the back and forth. Like, what's original Superman? There's been so many versions of Superman, but guns pulling from all different kind of places to make like a new bricolage version. Like this is like James Gunn's revision, but what he likes of Superman.
Yeah.
So he's kind of doing kind of what Disney does in terms of choosing like a classic story motif and like adding elements that work for a certain place and time. And you know, Gunn could have omitted any number of these things.
Well, here we go. We'll break the seal. Andor.
Okay.
In much the same way, you take the story motifs of Star Wars, and then are you telling what story do you want to tell with those characters and parameters?
Mm-hmm.
Tony Gilroy doesn't bring out any lightsabers to tell his story.
Maybe. Maybe two lightsabers.
Maybe. But it is, he's not relying upon that to tell his part of the story, but it's still working within that universe. James Gunn is not, is taking his own unique focus.
Yeah.
And his own appreciation of what it is, too. If he's going back to issue two to get his country names, hey, that's great.
It's also interesting because here we are, these IPs are old enough that they're kind of are our American fairy tales now. And so they're not just living in their own original universe anymore. They're subject to adaptability now because they are such a part of our culture.
And I'm going to lay peoplehood credit. These characters are all made by Jewish writers.
Oh,
yeah.
Almost across the board in DC and Marvel, and they're drawing heavily from rabbinic storytelling and Jewish storytelling typology. Yeah. Heavily.
So I want to hear about this,
okay,
Rabbi.
Okay. Yes. Yes.
Because you've mentioned this in some of our private conversations. You're saying that I think like the parallels with Moses, a lot of people know about those. Those are pretty like surface level, baby in a basket.
Right.
But you were saying that you think he's inspired by Midrash about Abraham?
Abraham.
Okay. So, and I never heard this before.
So one of the Midrashic motifs that the rabbis do is take an element from a story in one location and then apply it to another location.
Okay.
So the baby in the basket motif, or the baby whose life is threatened, who is then hidden away, and then later emerges to save or to change the world in some way. So yes, Moses, but the rabbis take that and they apply it to Abraham.
Okay.
So Abraham is born during the time of the hunter king Nimrod, which is not an insult. Bugs Bunny made that term an insult by calling Elmer Fudd a Nimrod.
What a Nimrod.
What a Nimrod. What a Nimrod. Who was a great hunter.
Right.
He was like the hunter.
Yeah.
So Nimrod is told that a baby is going to be born who's going to undermine his claims of divinity. And he then puts out a decree to kill all baby boys. Abraham and Abraham's parents have him, and he's hidden away in a cave until the threat passes, and he emerges sort of on his own and immediately acquires his superpower, which is monotheism. He sees the world as it actually is, and he sees through the idolatrous claims, such as Nimrod is a god. He sees that Nimrod is a person. So he sees the world, and he intuits in a very Greco-Roman philosophical kind of way, oh, the world must be run by some unseen force that must be God. And there must be only one. So he kind of gets to the prime mover real quick. And then he becomes a problem for Nimrod, who tries to kill him at every turn. So at one point, Nimrod sends men to try to stab him, and the knife shatters on his skin. So he's like the Man of Steel. He does fly in certain rabbinic midrashim because God makes him move around quickly so he can fly.
Okay.
Nimrod is Abraham's archenemy in the way that Lex Luthor is Superman's archenemy. And there's a lot of interesting parallels in those early storytellings.
Interesting. No kryptonite, though.
Does he have a weakness? Well, this is more my opinion. He has too much faith in God. I think Abraham fails at the binding of Isaac.
Oh, okay.
And he is fired, and he is no longer, God no longer talks to him. So that's another story motif for a different time.
Oh, you think Abraham should have challenged God?
I think that's
an interesting.
I have a whole take on the binding of Isaac that is very particular, which basically is God tells Abraham to offer up Isaac. Does not say slaughter your son, and God intervenes the moment Abraham picks up the knife, and God says, whoa, 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 I did not say, and like classic rabbinic midrash says, I didn't say kill him, I said offer him, like what are you doing? So implying that maybe Abraham was about to go too far and even maybe failed the test.
Midrash Andrew.
Midrash Rashi. It's Rashi and the classic rabbinic midrash.
Okay,
not
cool.
Me at all. I'm quoting the quoting the old dead guys.
Okay. Good. Well, that's really helpful to me, actually.
There are a lot of, like, Superman parallels. And, like, that, like, you know, the hero grows up secluded and privately and then emerges on the scene and kind of, like, bursts forth and changes the world. You see that with Abraham. You see it with also the Baal Shem Tov, the founder of Hasidism. The stories of his early childhood and his emergence on the scene, very similar. He reads like a superhero story.
Hmm.
And he changes Jewish life in the Carpathian Mountains for the Jews of Ukraine. And then later the world. There's a lot of similar heroic, superhero elements to his story.
So, speaking as a goy, the parallel I see, it's not just this these biblical figures, but it seems to me that Siegel and Schuster are also trying to capture a little bit of the Jewish experience in America of being a stranger, and an alien.
In a strange land.
In a land that doesn't know what to do with them sometimes. And sometimes responds in a, you know, an aggressive, fearful way.
Yeah. Clark Kent is a nebbish. He's a nerd.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that's not who he really is. He's really Kal-El. The outside nebbishy nerd is the facade. He's really a mensch. You know, he's really like a phenomenal person.
Yeah.
That's who he really is. But people don't get to see that. They just see the external nerdy version of Clark Kent.
But Gunn, he is like kind of a nerd, right?
He's very punk rock.
He's very, yeah, now, which I love. Like, the, you know, seeing the beauty in everyone is the real punk rock. I love that line.
Yeah, it's a great line.
I think there's something too. Where does he fit in? And we brought this up earlier. What actually makes Clark Kent or Superman alien?
Mm-hmm.
And your line was that it's not that he's from Krypton, it's that he's from Kansas.
Yeah, that's I think that's what makes him an alien, yeah.
I think what's interesting to me about that is how deep do your roots go? So I've lived in Wichita, Kansas City, Tulsa. What's great about living in a city is you don't have to go very far to become anonymous. You don't have to live with your family's past or any of those sort of things. But then when I've lived in small towns, it's like, man, there is a history and a legacy that goes before you, whether you like it or not.
Yep.
Both for good and for bad. You know, somebody's strong legacy goes before you. Where do you get to craft your own place out of there? And so I think that's interesting in that Clark Kent slash Superman is the only one we're asking, where does he come from?
Yeah.
What are his roots? Whereas everybody else is able to, in many ways, shed that rootedness. It doesn't matter where they come from because they are, they exist. But he's got some kind of past that we're going to interrogate. And the movie does a great job of lifting up what is his real past.
Yeah.
Is his real past more immediate, or is it what sent him to there in the in the first place?
Or is it his perception of what sent him there in the first place?
Yeah.
Because he thinks his parents sent them there to do good.
Yeah.
But then the message, as later decoded, redefines what is good.
But then Jonathan Kent points out to him, it's not because he thought that's what he was supposed to do from this message, it's because he'd chosen to do these things. Mm-hmm. As my wife said, the message of the film is that there's this tension between belief and choice.
Mm-hmm. Right?
And your choices determine who you are. It's not just what you believe.
So I'll bring back Abraham again. There's a very famous rabbinic midrash that Abraham, who is this ardent monotheist in an all pagan world, his father runs an idol shop, and he makes idols and he sells them. And Abraham knows that his father's job is absurd. And one day he's left alone to tend the store. While his father away, he smashes all the idols, puts a club in the hand of the biggest one left unsmashed. His dad comes back in and says, Abraham, what happened? And Abraham says, well, the biggest one smashed all the others. And his father says, well, that's ridiculous. I made these all yesterday. Abraham says, do you hear yourself? Like, they're nothing. Like, what are you doing selling idols? And so this is where he becomes the iconoclast. He literally smashes the idols. And in some way, maybe even gets Terach to realize also that he is ridiculous or his work is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And then they do all leave Ur, the big city. They leave Metropolis.
Mm-hmm.
And they go to the small town. By the way.
Yeah.
So there's also the Abraham story is really also like an anti ancient civilization story. It's an anti Ur, which is basically like the big city.
There's a anxiety about progress in civilization in some of these texts. Yeah, that's for sure.
The rabbis thought that large cities easily would dehumanize people.
Mm-hmm.
There's an old story that I think that like when they were building like the Tower of Babel, like people were actually like that like fell like were in the building. They just like were never rescued, just left to die in the mortar, and then just like built upon. So there's like you know there's no value of human life in the large city building. But Abraham there rejects his parents and everybody's culture and chooses his own way. Clark Kent gets to choose to embrace his, well, he thought he knew what his parents wanted, when he learns what they really wanted, he doesn't choose it. So he's, in some ways, he smashes that.
Yeah.
The idolatry of what they demanded of him, but he doesn't take it. Doesn't. Oh, I was wrong. I will now do this. But everyone thinks he does. They assume the worst immediately.
Right. Yeah.
Like, he's too good to be true. He's also pretty new, though.
Right.
So yes. they don't really know him that well. I mean, he's new enough to be trusted, but not a generation of trust. You know, like a couple years, 3 years.
Yeah.
So the message is still very clearly in the movie very plausibly true for the large audience.
Well, and there's also the monkey bots.
That was hilarious. Oh, my God.
Are generating, all this negative press or social media.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is before that.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's like a proclivity, like people just need to be pushed over the edge, I think, is the idea. Like, they...
Because he always said he was an alien.
Yeah.
So everyone knows he's an alien.
Right.
Which is interesting, too. He says, I was very clear about that. Yeah. I am from Krypton. It is gone. I am an alien. Like the interview with Lois, he's always, right. I've always been very clear. I guess once he shows up, he's very transparent with his actual back, as he understands it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Which is interesting, too. I don't know if anybody, I think that's also in the Donner versions. He's very clear that he is an alien.
Your next question about what it means to be human, what it means to be alien, and I would say, like, welcomed in to that external system right there.
Did we say what it means to be American?
The movie does not even touch it, and people were upset about the omission of that classic motif.
But I think because it would be, like, a little too on the nose, maybe. I don't know.
This movie was on the nose about a lot of things.
Yeah.
And comic book versions also had stopped America. I think in one comic book version, Superman actually renounces his American passport.
Wow.
He says, I'm now a citizen of Earth, no longer one country. Okay. That's in some of the runs. I forget where.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Well, that idea of human and welcomed in versus alien.
Yeah.
And how we're controlling that narrative, too.
Yeah.
Where's the trust in many ways of people who are not from here, people who are alien, and especially because you're in Metropolis, which is a big city. There's not a lot of people who are necessarily from there, but if he's holding on to his past roots and not in some ways assimilating, is that where the welcome is lost? And then, you get to the monkeys who are creating all sorts of fabricated lies about him, but how quickly are people willing to believe fabricated lies?
Yeah.
In contrast to able to believe the good that comes from a superhuman who can fend off bigger problems.
Who's done nothing but good.
Right.
Yeah.
And of course, he looks totally human, too. I mean, the thing that's weird is he could totally pass as... I mean, he can pass as human. He has nothing about his physiology on the outside that looks even remotely alien.
Right. When I lived in Israel, so we were in Israel 9 years, and frequently people would come up to me on the street and they'd start speaking in Russian. They would assume that I was a Russian, but that I was Jewish. I didn't look different from Israelis. And in some of my relationships, like, everyone was always very, for the most part, very kind and gracious. But the minute they learned that I was Christian, the relationship changed. Like, they had questions. Like, it wasn't bad. It was
but
just,
it changed.
It was different. It taught me a lot about, without that experience, I would not know what it's like to be a minority somewhere. Although it was a different kind of minority because, like Superman, I look like everyone else. Really,
right?
Didn't make it worse, but made it different.
Yeah, it's interesting being Jewish in the past couple of years, especially in the past year, feeling much more the outsider than ever before in my entire life as well. Because what's happening in Israel and with the Palestinian people in Gaza, and the anti-Semitic voices that have been riding that wave of legitimate concern that go way beyond legitimate concern and action towards bringing back anti-Semitism.
Do you ever feel like you should take off your kippah?
In the past few months, much more than I ever have in my entire life. So I usually wear it out without any concern, and I have never experienced anything negative in Wichita. But this is just more of a feeling that, like, what if? I have never had a bad experience in Wichita. If anything, I've gotten like support.
Yeah.
Which has been, you know, if not lovely, weird. right. It's like, whoa, that's a lot of support.
Yeah.
It's like, okay.
What kind of support are we talking about here?
Sometimes it's the kind that you wish you weren't getting.
Yeah.
It's like supportive, but wow, that's like problematic support.
Well, and from our, you know, Matthew and I's perspective as well, there's a lot of Christian nationalism that supports Judaism in a way that it props up Christian nationalism.
That's right.
It is a manipulation of this that honestly to me feels more anti-Semitic than most other things that you'd see.
And that certainly is partially where it's coming from.
Yeah.
And you know, people who are very, very pro-Israel at the expense of anybody else living in Gaza, West Bank, or Palestine.
Right.
Yeah. It's like, whoa, with friends like this, who needs enemies?
Yeah.
So I appreciate the support, but I don't want it to be at the expense of other human beings.
Yep.
And that's a very
fraught. I had an argument with someone about that yesterday. Yeah. It's
it is fraught.
Yeah. Difficult.
Yeah. So feeling like an outsider is you know, glad you had the experience of being an outsider like that.
Yeah, no, I'm grateful for it. But yeah, it's weird.
Yeah. Most Americans don't get to have that feeling. For such a prolonged span of time as well, 9 years. I mean, I have not lived in Israel for 9 years. Wow, I lived there for 2 years and then some. Not 9 years. You were in Jerusalem the whole time?
Beersheba.
Ooh, very different place to live, too.
Yeah. We had to learn Hebrew.
You do. That's a good thing.
Yeah, no, it was great.
Yeah, living in Jerusalem, you do not need to learn Hebrew. They do not want to hear your bad Hebrew. They would rather speak use their bad English on you. I did a summer in Haifa as part of my college year abroad, and they were very happy not to speak have to speak English. When you leave the big cities, it's much, you know, people learn Hebrew, they learn English a lot less.
Yep.
Which makes learning Hebrew a lot easier.
One of the things that's related to this, so Superman's origins obviously has to do, like, whose family does he belong to? Who is his family? Jor-El and Lara, are they his family, or... we do have Supergirl at the end.
Right.
So,
his first cousin.
So there is a little bit of Krypton there, but definitely the message of the movie is that Ma and Pa Kent are his real family and are really responsible for shaping him. And he seems to be almost unaware of that.
So family is not biological.
Not strictly, no, yeah.
No, his physiology is biological.
Right.
But his family is relational.
Right.
But he thought he had at least that one message of relating to his parents. He wanted to carry on their legacy. So he did feel some responsibility to his biological parents.
Yeah.
But then when they let him down, he does reject their legacy.
Yeah.
And he gets to basically... more fully embrace his parents as like his family.
Yeah.
And not them.
So family's not biological, but it's not just arbitrary either.
Like
he doesn't choose his family.
But it's arbitrary. It is arbitrary. He lands in their property.
Or it's providential, depending. Yeah.
Which is not addressed in the slightest in the film.
Because
in the Donner film,
they
do talk about this feels like divine providence.
Yeah.
Which attests to their being Methodist.
Yes.
So there is some theology that the parents feel is at play in the original Donner films.
And Gunn leaves all that, which I think is...
That's not the question he's looking to answer.
Yeah. But I do think that's a little bit of a blind spot, is that you got these Kansas farmers. I mean, they go to church every Sunday, no doubt, like in my mind. And you don't need to like spread it on too thick, but just acknowledge it would be nice. But that's all right.
It would be fun to have a scene of Clark in the church choir, as you mentioned.
Right.
But he sings too loud and like knocks everything over.
Oh, yeah.
They never use that. Kal-El, voice of God, let's hear it.
Yeah.
That'd be kind of cool.
That would be cool.
If you were to like super sing, what would... I mean, it would be like disastrous. Disastrous.
The stained glass windows just like... Yeah, shatter. Awesome.
There's one Christmas play where they start to sing "O Holy Night." He goes for the high note.
I mean, for me as a rabbi, for whom conversion is a really big part of like my community, a lot of my community here in Wichita are people who have chosen Judaism and converted. You know, Clark, biology not being determinative
right.
of who you belong to yeah. is a really powerful message as well. You can choose who you want to connect to. Actually, I learned from Professor Ben Summers, professor at JTS, my alma mater for a medical school, that there is an Amorite text which predates Israel's emergence on the scene that shows that people change their family tree. Like, I am no longer part of this family. Yeah. I am now part of this family. People could choose their family.
Covenant text. Yes.
Even just, but this is like, even just like familial. Yeah. Like, so-and-so is now part of this family. They just right. change their familial affiliation through
yeah.
choice,
yeah.
which is probably what undergirded, like, an early sense of people choosing to be Israel.
Yeah.
In yeah, like very early memory and came back later.
Yeah.
So choosing family is deeply part of Israel's culture.
Mm-hmm.
Not the state, like Israel, the people's
right,
culture.
Right.
There's also one in Leviticus 19:2. It says, everyone should revere their mother and father, or father and mother,
mm-hmm.
And keep my Sabbaths. So how much do you actually revere your parents? You should, until they tell you to violate the Sabbath.
Right.
So revering one's parents, as he does, you know,
yeah.
from that point it would come as a limit on when they ask him to violate, for him, his core ethics.
Right.
So, yeah. which he does not do.
Which he's learned from the Kents.
He really learned from the Kents.
Yeah.
Like, they're, yeah. that he realizes that they're really his parents.
Yeah.
He kind of like, because once his parents are aligned with Jor-El and Lara, fine. But when his parents... his biological parents really are asking him to violate his core ethics. Mm-hmm. He's like, no.
Yeah.
So the limit of... he might still revere his parents in a way, but not in how he acts.
Yeah. I'm fascinated by... so I was thinking... I watched Iron Man with my girls a few... like last week. Because they have not seen those old MCU films.
Old.
And, yeah,
they're almost 18 years
old.
Iron Man is 18 years old.
Yeah.
I think it was 2008.
But Tom was born that year.
Yeah, it's crazy.
He was born in the year of Iron Man.
And,
but, we live by the Marvel calendar.
But it's such a different feeling from Fantastic Four, from Superman. Like, you got... there's still that kind of lone wolf superhero thing. Like, you get with Batman... right. All through the 90s, the ideal superhero.
The vigilante.
Exactly, yeah.
I mean, he may be rich and brilliant, he's still a vigilante.
Yep.
He's acting with impunity, without regard for anybody else but his own sensibility.
Yep. And his parents are dead and gone. Like, his dad built the company.
Because Bucky killed them.
Right. But they're, like, the family isn't really a big part of it. And just even... growing up in the 90s, you'd have all the, like, The Simpsons. Like, the dad's always kind of buffoonish. And, yeah, I love The Simpsons. But still, like, there was sort of some skepticism about the family in the 90s. The nuclear family. And it seems like family is sexy again. I don't know what to make of it.
Family is sexy again. You know, one of the greatest shows that my daughter Avia told me about to watch, which is a very wonderful, is Bob's Burgers.
Yes.
That family, amen. They love each other in right. all their weirdness. Great show.
Yeah. And,
show.
Foibles, like, you know, Bob and Linda are quirky, but they're real and they love the kids so much. And the kids need them. Yeah, it's
a very lovely show. But it's a very, it's you know, that... family becoming sexy again. Right. So many versions. Pa Kent dies.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, maybe he'll die later. I mean, he will. He's not immortal. But, like, right. in this movie, they did not need to fridge his father
that's
to
right.
motivate him.
That's
which
right.
is good.
Yeah.
Stop killing people's parents.
But it's
to motivate them to do good.
That question of, you know, questioning... well, the questioning of the nuclear family is... important, because the nuclear family is not just good because it is a nuclear family.
Amen. Right.
And so that questioning, Bob's Burgers is great, it's funny. It doesn't mean that Bob is, you know, immortal or Superman himself.
No.
There's certainly a value of holding on to those who have raised you and
yep.
those who you're a part of family with. And so for Clark, he's still holding on to the values and the family and the welcome that he received by the Kents. Yeah. Even if he would love to say this is part of my heritage in unavoidable ways, it's still the idea that there is a value that he's been raised with, a value that he holds true to, and he's gonna put it up against there. Honor your father and mother, except for if, hey, hold on, the Sabbath is important too. Let's keep that. And I think that's where that term of value and family really puts in tension.
Right.
And it makes you ask, who is family? Who are the ones that come within there?
Back to the fish out of water thing. Like, he is delightfully awkward and so good and compassionate, but he's Kansas in
right.
Metropolis.
Right. He's also naive.
He's naive, yeah.
Right, we talked about earlier that...
Makes mistakes, but...
Yeah, I liked how you helped me reframe seeing him as the fish out of water, new to the big city, new to the big apricot, can't get through crowds very well because he's never had to deal with a crowd before, like Travis said, and then he gets involved in geopolitical affairs and he's way over his head.
Yeah.
Yeah.
3 years out, I really enjoyed this naive...
Because he's used to small-town politics.
Yeah.
Which operates on a whole other level.
And a clarity of... If I do this, this is good.
Mm-hmm.
So why wouldn't I do XYZ things? Versus international politics, where what you think is good to one person will be viewed differently by another. And the fact that he's going in there trying to help people and it's being viewed as, we can't really do that. I think the whole thing wrestles with an idea of what is evil.
Hmm.
We're happy to return to the colorful Superman here, the bright colors and most of the film. You could see sky and it wasn't overcast and ominous.
Did it rain once?
But the idea of Lex Luthor then being in a foreboding skyscraper, twin skyscrapers, where the sky bridge was his vehicle. Lex Luthor really takes on this idea of, I'm going to represent evil that's going on right here. And of course, we've got good and evil, but it's asking, where does Superman fit in this? Is Superman just always good? What happens when Superman struggles?
Yeah.
What happens when he can't defeat evil? And I think that question really makes this something to wrestle with. The pocket universe.
Yeah.
Superman is completely restricted, and yet he still holds on to those values when put and is able to get out of the pocket universe by appealing to other values.
Yeah.
And other people's compassion and sense of right and wrong. The Elemental Man.
Yeah. He's being the Elemental Man is being used to harm Superman as an enforcement tool of the evil Lex Luthor. Can't you see he's evil? Well, maybe, but I'm being employed by him to do these sort of things until...
And he has my infant child.
Yeah.
You're held hostage.
So Superman's helping him to realize that power, but he's doing it through the part of compassion. The most brutal part of the movie is when the street vendor... who I'm forgetting his name right now, which
Malik.
Okay, so that's the entire point right there, is that, he killed him. Yeah, his name was Malik.
Yeah.
That was a brutal moment. I was shocked that they did that, and that Lex basically did not, he's like, that was kind of fast. Like, that was his reaction. Yeah. Like, I thought this game would go on longer. That was shocking. That was a real decision to make that so brutal.
Not throw away characters in this film.
They do not.
Yeah, like in even Malik has...
Right, no, yeah, even Malik gets like a full page spread in the end as a memorial to being a victim of Lex Luthor's evil. But Lex Luthor's complaint about Superman is interesting because is he right or wrong? Is Superman showing up making humanity complacent and reliant upon Deus Ex Machina to solve all their problems?
It's an interesting question.
His fear is that humanity will become lazy and rely upon superheroes. Oh, don't worry. That superhero, the person in the cape, will solve my problems. I don't have to solve any of my own problems. I will remain childlike in my humanity and never aspire to be more than I am now. That's not an illegitimate concern. Mm-hmm. Of course, the movie reveals that his solution is buy my technology.
Right. Yeah.
He is still a tech bro at heart in this movie, and the engineer, who is basically all nanites, feels that she gave up her humanity to support him, and he wants to make that techno culture in Jarenpur. He says that, but he also has some tech to sell you. So
yeah,
he's not altruistically pro-humanity. He wants to make a buck or a trillion from his solution to the problem. So
I think if you've got a flying sky bridge from two skyscrapers, you're making a few more bucks than normal.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So I think that what he says is interesting, but I don't believe that that's the actual reason he hated Superman.
But it is an interesting question to ponder. I'm hearing implied in what you're asking sort of the old Marxist argument, right? Is religion just an opiate? Like that
superhero worship
is an easy fix, or is religion a crutch that a real, fully fledged human doesn't need because they've got their own powers to? I don't know. Is that
George Carlin thought it should be a lift in your shoe and not a crutch?
Religion
should be it makes you feel taller.
Who said that?
George Carlin.
Oh.
Not a guy who loved religion.
Yeah, I was going
to
say.
He thought it should be a lift in your shoe and not a crutch or a cudgel to make people limp or to beat them down.
Rabbi George Carlin.
Far from it.
I'm
a fan, but far from it.
The reason I think religious people react so strongly to those claims from atheists and Marxists and such is because there is a little sting to it, right? Because we know that faith can be a crutch. Or you can sort of try to leave it all to God, and that can be a way of deferring responsibility.
But that's also the caricature of what religion is, too.
Yeah, no, it's
faith without works is dead. And so that idea of I'm going to have total faith, but I'm going to abandon my works is...
Right.
That's weird.
But it's a reality for some folks. And then you really have to ask those questions of what does my faith and my religion call upon me to do? Where is my trust within this? And so I think it is responding to a caricature to say, we're just going to let religion take care of this and we're going to rely upon this too heavy. And again, that gets to Luther. Luther is...
Lex Luther, right?
Lex Luther, yeah.
Not Martin Luther?
Luther, yeah.
It's spelled differently. Yes. No relation.
You didn't hear that in there? I think that gets to Lex...
As a Catholic here, I'm going to wait a second. I'm going to take a cheap shot.
No, I think that gets to Lex Luther really trying to say that this is not something that any superhuman can fix within here. And it is completely... upon technology and upon science and upon the works that we do. It almost, I could see Lex Luthor's position being one that has no room for God.
Yeah.
It has no room for any external motivations. And I think that's something that you can get way too philosophical, way too self-reliant, any of those sort of things.
Nietzschean.
That turns you into a bad guy, even if you may have some great points.
Yeah.
Okay, hey, thanks, Lex Luthor. We appreciate your thought on this, and, we'd love to work on that. Also, can you, stop killing people?
Yeah.
I mean...
His willingness to let the city be destroyed is reveals, his true lack of compassion and love for humanity. He really is all in for himself.
Yeah.
So he might... say that he's trying to help humanity or he's upset that humanity can no longer aspire, but nothing else he does actually supports that claim at the end of the film. That's right. What he's really motivated by.
Yeah.
So it kind of rings hollow the more I think about what he said. We were talking in the preamble to recording that, you know, Maimonides' theology in his Jewish law code begins with, like, you know, understanding God as the first order of business. And for him, and this is, you know, one rabbinic theology, is that God is not going to ever swoop in to save you. You know, he's like, you're sick, you should go see your doctor about mm-hmm. that. And he was a doctor. He was a rationalist. He was a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And then the end of his law code ends with, and humanity's got to figure out war, poverty, and hunger. So for Maimonides, he actually does think like Lex Luthor in some ways, but he actually means it in a more authentic, heartfelt way, which was, you know, we're the key to our own salvation. And the mm-hmm. the law builds upon the grace of God's creation to help us do
right.
that. Mm-hmm. So that's a much more positive way of what I think Lex Luthor was hinting at, but not actually believing. Or maybe he did believe it, but he had a warped, self-centered way of actually, you know, doing something about it.
Well, and I hear within Maimonides a sense that there is God.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah. That's like,
there
that's
is.
Like
well,
number
yeah,
one.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's number one. But there's also something that you turn to aside from yourself. Can right. Lex Luthor understand, you know, everything that he wants to understand and then put it into the way that he wants to make it happen?
He should read some Rambam.
There we
go. I think he might like the Rambam, actually. I do think he would like the Rambam. Does Lex Luthor even read much? I don't think he reads.
One last thing that just comes to mind that I appreciate about this is Superman needs people in a way that he hasn't always in other films. When Jarunpur is coming under attack and the kid puts up the flag with the S and you're like, how's Superman going to do both things? Well, he's not. Like, he's going to let the Justice Gang take care of it. And Krypto winds up saving the day.
Krypto.
And
he's not a very good dog at that.
But and I appreciate that. Superman needs a community to really be Superman.
Mm-hmm. He can't do it alone.
Again, the small town versus the big city.
Yeah.
Because as much as big cities are community, because you can become so anonymous, they're not places of accountability or...
Yeah.
They're not necessarily places of true belonging. Anything can happen there, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it'll have that larger impact.
Yeah.
Whereas the Justice Gang, they are starting to be a place of accountability and remembering and continuing on this work. And a place that gets to ask those questions, not from... presidential standpoint of have you crossed this international border and done this sort of thing, but asking where the true goodness is, where the true saving of life is.
Well, he gets that from Lois too.
Yeah.
Asking those questions he doesn't want to be asked.
We need to highlight that scene, my goodness. That
the
scene,
interview scene?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That 10 minutes of screen time, which, I mean, that's a giant chunk of the movie.
Yeah.
But what a scene that is.
And it didn't end with a weird poem. Like the Donner film did.
No, but you can't get out of the awkwardness of that scene. That's what I really liked about it, is that you cannot get out of it.
Yeah.
You really are sitting in there trying to solve this with them in real time. You just expected that they might be looking from the screen at you, like, what do you think, huh?
Yeah, and it's a very real, people who love each other have fights.
Yeah.
And, and they can be repaired.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah.
Right, she almost walks away from a relationship.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought it was really interesting just seeing them talk about geopolitics and him being in over his head and not thinking it through. And
being challenged by it.
Mm-hmm.
That's what our spouses do for us. You know, for me, at least.
Right.
She rubs off all the rough edges.
Right. He's not rational.
Yeah.
He's very emotional. He thinks with his gut.
You said he's impulsive.
He's clearly impulsive. He thinks with his heart.
Yeah.
And his gut. He doesn't think with his head much.
because he doesn't have to, because he can do anything.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, big heart.
But you need a place where that can be the case. You need a safe area for that to be the case. And honestly, that, yeah, like you said.
Where they can have that out, they can hash it out?
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be a complete and total... I thought this was off the record. Or, you know, this stuff is not on the record or whatever.
He also new to reporting.
Yeah.
He's not sure how these things work.
But that, you know, I don't... There are many conversations I have with my spouse that I don't want to be on the record because, right. You know, I'm being dumb. I'm working this out. We're working this out in real time together. Yeah. And so... You know, if she's coming back at me with, well, you said this one time. Yeah, but I was wrong. We need a space for that where we're not completely public facing the entire time. We're not completely worked within that. So, yeah, that I like that dynamic as well.
Yeah.
Let's end with Kara, Supergirl.
Oh, okay, yeah.
She is the drunk party girl because she sees Krypton destroyed. She sees Argo, the one city, saved, and then that destroyed. And she has experienced so much trauma.
Yeah.
The Supergirl comic book they're going to be bringing into the movie next summer is where I think she works through the trauma.
Hmm.
And no longer needs to hang it on red star planets and gets drunk.
And she hasn't been raised by the Kents.
Correct.
So there's a...
Now she shows up as a teenager.
Yeah.
And I'm very excited to see where that goes. Apparently Gunn loves the script and he greenlit it right away because it was ready.
Wow.
He's not going to be greenlighting unready script because of whatever. So I'm very excited about that.
Yeah.
So I thought it was hinting at another really great story coming up that's rooted in human experience.
Yeah.
How do we handle our... trauma and, you know, move on from it without forgetting it, but learning from it and healing from it to an extent.
And very different, not as wholesome a character.
No. They could have gone wholesome. The DC TV version, Kara.
Mm-hmm.
Melissa Benoit, huge fan. She's great. She's very, like, the wholesome thing. This is the non-wholesome Kara.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very glad we're going to see something that we haven't seen before on big screen or small screen. Very excited about that. So... optimistic am I about James Gunn and the DC cinematic universe.
Yeah, I really appreciate just the depths that we're getting to go into with this. And, I mean, for a 2-hour movie, it wasn't just a continuous stream of, here, meet this person, here, meet this person. They really interconnected in a way that, again, like we talked about, the Justice Gang.
I was worried
for
that. I thought... he was introducing too many characters at once, but it worked, I thought.
You know, you really get to see Mr. Fantastic the most
and
how he operates.
Terrific.
Mr. Terrific. Mr. Terrific. Different movie. Different studio. Yeah. Mr. Terrific, the T.
Yes.
Yeah. The actor said that the T was real, and it did move with his face. I don't know what the material was, but it was not CGI. It was there. He was acting in it. Pretty cool tech.
Hmm.
Love seeing his tech.
Yeah.
No, he's fun. Expensive.
Yes. Yeah, it's so cool.
Yeah. And he was just, you know, how just the scene like, where he walks through the camp to get to the wormhole thing and Lois is the bubble. That's
amusing.
Yeah.
Bubbly music going
Very much Star-Lord attacking those people in the opening scene. Very much that James Gunn kind of scene.
Yeah.
It's James Gunn. It's good.
Yeah.
That was a lot of fun. Yeah. But I like, you know, just enough Green Lantern, enough Hawk Girl, get a sense of the characters. And actually, like, the big narrative issue that they have in the DC is, what about Batman?
Yeah.
They may never bring him in. They may just can't deal with it.
I mean,
that's neither here nor there. That's not my problem. But they may never actually make him part of this stuff. Just, it's too weird. Like, which version? Who?
Yeah.
Another one?
Yeah.
Another Batman?
Right.
Please. There have been 8.
So this concludes this episode of Sacred Realms, the Sacred on Superman. So thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this conversation about the nexus of sci-fi, fantasy, religion, and spirituality. Please come back to hear more. Share this and invite some folks to listen. If you liked it, please give us a positive rating or review on Apple Podcast or whatever app you are using to find your podcast. Again, share this. Thank you for your positive reviews, delightful emails so far. This episode was recorded and edited using Descript, and you can reach us with questions, comments, and suggestions at sacredrealmspodcast@gmail.com. Keep exploring the sacred and the realms.